Hello and welcome to Continent of Media 0501, recorded January 10th, 2005, and to be released later as World of Radio Extra 55. I'm Glenn Hauser. Continent of Media is made possible by Universal Radio for quality amateur and shortwave radio equipment. For a catalog, phone them at 1-800-431-3939 or check their website, www.universal-radio.com. Universal also sponsors dxing.com, where you'll find much more information, including the latest edition of this program and access to DX Listening Digest. Continent of Media is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave. Let's begin with some Latin American items, but many of them related to North America. On the WTFDA list, Dave Pomeroy from Topeka, Kansas, says, I was in Ecuador in November. They use NTSC, that is the same TV system as in the U.S. I had a 5-inch black-and-white portable with me. It has a continuous UHF tuner, so I'm not sure of the exact channels, but both VHF and UHF were in use. On election night, I was able to listen to U.S. Network News, no usable video, from ABC, CBS, and NBC, somewhere around Channel 65. One audio was from Channel 35 in Erie, Pennsylvania, WSEE, and another from Channel 2 in Nashville. I have no idea where these signals were coming from. Bob Cooper in New Zealand replied, they would have been through EchoStar or DirecTV, which are widely pirated by cables and broadcasters throughout the Caribbean and northern South America. And Jeff Kitsko added, they would be coming from the AMC3 satellite, where the Primetime 24 package includes WSEE 35, WKRN2 in Nashville, and also WNBC Channel 4, uplinked for Big Dish owners. Now, why did an obscure affiliate in the small market of Erie, Pennsylvania, get to be the satellite source for CBS? I recall a previous discussion, one reason being that it had a record of not preempting the network. But why don't they use WCBS itself? Could it be that the network's flagship preempts the network more than the affiliate in Erie? Those are comments from yours truly. George McClintock in Tennessee, who has visited Anguilla several times, writes this for DX Listening Digest about the Caribbean Beacon. The 690 frequency was originally two 50-kilowatt transmitters, and it remains authorized for 100. Before it was bought by Dr. Gene Scott, the station had deteriorated to the point where parts from one of the 50s had to be used to keep the other one going. That has been running at 50 kilowatts since, not 15 as someone had reported. It gets out very well in the Caribbean with its tall tower, diplexed, by the way, with their other frequency 1610, currently at much lower power. Also, 690 has the advantage of being a low frequency and surrounded by water. While that, 6090 and 11775 on shortwave carry nothing but the university network, 1610 does have some separate programming before local noon or 1600 UT. As for Radio Anguilla, the government station on 1505, that moved to FM some time ago with an LCOR transmitter following storm damage. There are now a few private FM stations on Anguilla. Taxi drivers are no longer motivated to listen to off-island stations for something less boring than Radio Anguilla. Remember Ken McHarg, who hosted HCJB's DX Party Line for a while and still appears occasionally with his tips for real living? He also wrote this to DX News of the National Radio Club in December. He's now in Costa Rica. Hello from San Jose, where we've been living for the past 7 months. Polly and I are missionaries with the Latin American Mission, teaching at the Evangelical University of the Americas. She teaches English as a second language, and my field is communications. We lived here for 8 months in 1990 while learning Spanish in preparation for our work at HCJB. The radio scene has changed a lot since then, with the then-famous Radio Reloj having been bought by the Monumental Group. Now Radio Reloj is primarily the news department of Monumental. They did an excellent job following the 6.2 earthquake along the Pacific coast. For economic reasons, a number of AM stations, including Faro del Caribe, sign off at 6 p.m. rather than transmit all night. One other difference is the growth in English-language stations on the FM dial, and others with a lot of English music. 1FM also carries the BBC World Service news a couple of times a day. Reception of North American and Caribbean stations here in the Central Valley, especially in the city where we live, is very spotty. On good nights, I can get Bahamas on 1540 and the Virgin Islands on 1620. Along the Atlantic coast at Kawita, many more U.S. stations can be heard, including a number of the non-50-kilowatt stations such as WIOD 610 in Miami, WFLA 970 in Tampa, and a few others from the Florida Keys. Along the Pacific coast, I heard one or two California stations around 2 a.m. I do miss more English programming, as shortwave possibilities are greatly diminished since 1990, when one could easily hear HCJB here every night, as well as VOA. Now it's BBC with a poor signal and occasionally RCI and Radio Netherlands. A few of the North American private stations are heard well, in particular WHRI via South Carolina. He was looking forward to being back in the U.S. at Christmas to catch many clear channel stations with their variety of programming. About neighboring Nicaragua, Tetsuya Hirahara writes in Radio Nuevo Mundo about a website he found about the history of radio at Puerto Cabezas on the Atlantic coast. It's called Síntesis Histórica del Nacimiento y Desarrollo de la Radiodifusión en Puerto Cabezas, a historical review, and it mentions a shortwave station called Radio Mar in the 1960s on 5055 kilohertz starting in 1966. I really don't recall this one, but the article, in any event, from El Pelicano says it soon changed to medium wave 1265. And there's a brief history of Radio Swan at another website brought to our attention by Arnaldo Slein in Conexión Digital. This purports to be something called a Taylor Report and was originally Eyes Only Secret. It begins this way. On 17 March 1960, President Eisenhower approved a covert action program to bring about a replacement of the Castro regime. Within the propaganda framework, an important objective was to create and utilize a high-powered medium and shortwave radio station. CIA was asked to provide it outside the continental limits of the U.S. and have it ready for operation within 60 days. Swan Island in the Caribbean was chosen as an appropriate site. We'll include the exact link for this document. It's at the Cuban-Exile.com website. That is, the link will appear at the summary for this Continent Media 0501, accessible via our website, worldofradio.com. From the Mexican newspaper El Financiero, December 2nd, BBC Monitoring forwards this story. In translation, Mexican broadcasters complain of growing competition from U.S. digital signals. It was reported by José de Jesús Guadarrama H. Mexican radio broadcasters are facing limited competition from digital radio signals from the U.S. due to the development of a gray market, that is, an unauthorized market of imported devices which are installed in vehicles and which permit reception by means of the Digital Audio Radio Services System. This is at a time when the Mexican authorities have yet to define standards for launching the digitalization process of national radio and have not stemmed the growth of that market, which now encompasses at least 50,000 motorists, in spite of the fact that the National Chamber of Radio and Television, CIRT, filed a complaint over a sesquicentenario ago. Satellite digital radio signals come from Sirius and XM, and now Mexican concessionaires are becoming increasingly concerned about the presence of SES Americom, since if it wins the bidding for satellite orbit location 77 degrees west, it will have an enormous capacity for launching similar services. Mexico and the U.S. have reciprocity agreements by which the satellite footprints of both countries can overlap. In Mexico, it has not yet been determined which of the digital radio platforms, IBOC or Eureka 147, in the U.S. and Europe respectively, will be established in Mexico. On medium wave, news about some interesting formats, a couple of radio stations there. Mika Mikkelainen, DXing at Lemminjoki in Finland, reports to DXing.info hearing XESJ in Saltillo, Coahuila on 1250, December 1st at 0610 UT. Quite a nice catch way over in Finland. There was no ID or slogan, but spots for businesses in Saltillo. The station has a rare format, giving the time and current temperature every few minutes. And now there's one in Mexico City. from the Conexión Digital list, Roberto Edgar reported on January 1st that on that day, XEVOZ 1590 in Mexico City changed its programming. It had been known as Bonita 1590 with Music of My Land, but now it's Radio Reloj, The Time Every Minute, and much more. There are ads, of course, mixed in. It's more or less like the format previously used for 61 years by the legendary La Hora Exacta, which was on 1350 in Mexico City, XEQK, and also on shortwave for a while, 9555. XEVOZ 1590 belongs to the ASIR group, and it has already been DX'd in Europe as well. About Canada, I've been hearing a newscaster on CBC Radio during the times when I frequently tune in, as relayed by RCI as well, with a name I really can't make out. So I asked Bill Westenhaver, giving an approximate phonetic version, and he was able to identify the individual, even though he's not in the CBC personalities list, because I guess he's only a newsreader. I'm going to spell his name. D-Z-I-N-T-A-R-S. C-E-R-S, Zintars Sers. This is apparently a Latvian name. Someone of the same name and perhaps the same person was once in a Latvian rock band, according to a search Bill did. And from BC, Daniel Say adds, Zintars Sers has been on CBC Radio Sports for a decade or more. He also does weekend fill during long weekend news and other short continuity. Patrick Griffith from Denver reports to DX Listening Digest about his visit to the Northwest. I had a great tour of CKWX in Vancouver and posted some pictures on my AMDXer website. That is community.webtv.net/ in capitals AM-DXER, the last two letters being lowercase. Furthermore, in Washington State on vacation, he visited Everett to tour the Boeing plant, and also Mount Vernon to photograph the unusual Paran, P-A-R-A-N, antenna at radio station KAPS. Pictures of that as well on his AM-DXer website. Ben Dawson, consulting engineer in Washington State, has more news, this time from Portland, Oregon. On November 30th, the FCC granted program test authority for regular operation of the increased power facilities for KPOJ 620 in Portland. The new operation, like that of the previous 3 years, is diplexed into the antenna of 1190 KEX. The increase in power is for 25 kilowatts day, 10 at night, with a maximum lobe of both essentially due west, which may be useful for DXers in Japan and elsewhere in East Asia and the Pacific, especially since it is 1 kilohertz off the region 1 and 3 9 kilohertz spacing. KPOJ, originally KGW, is the oldest radio broadcasting station in the Pacific Northwest, commencing operation in 1922. From the mid-1930s until 3 years ago, it operated from a very elegant and favorable antenna site just south of the Columbia River in Vanport, or North Portland, until the site was wantonly and intentionally destroyed by the Port of Portland as part of an ill-considered water storage project, which would have been compatible with continued use of the antenna, except for the incompetence and intransigence of the port management. Fortunately, the licensee, a Clear Channel subsidiary, also owns KEX, and actually both stations were originally owned by the Oregonian newspaper, and KEX originally operated from the Vanport site as well. So the antenna configuration of the KEX site at Clackamas, southeast Portland, allowed its use for the 620 operation as well. You're listening to Continent of Media 0501. Our address, P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK 73702 USA, or WORADIO at yahoo.com. An item in the December issue of Shortwave Magazine from the UK caught my eye. It's in Ben Hogan's SSB Utilities column. The Federal Highway Administration have many communication modes available, but like many other American agencies, keep an HF system ready for use should the need arise. One of their areas tests the HF system every Wednesday at 1400 to 1500 UT. It's worth trying to monitor the traffic. At the beginning of the hour, they transmit on 4821. and thereafter at 10-minute intervals change to the following frequencies in this order: 5255, 7419.5, 9197, 10891, and at 1450 they finish up on 13434. All USB, and on occasions they may use some data traffic. Well, as a matter of fact, this is the mystery net I ran across some months ago, and I found most of the frequencies by searching the bands once I was tipped that they moved to a higher band every 10 minutes. There are a variety of call sign prefixes, and thus the agencies are also a variety, not just the FHWA. From December 19th through 23rd, there was a mysterious station which showed up on four shortwave frequencies: 3700, 4300, 6500, and 10500, all in double sideband, that is, both USB and LSB, but with no carrier. To hear it, you had to be quick or sit on any or all of these frequencies because they shifted frequencies every 10 seconds in a 40-second cycle. Was this a serious test of some new secret system, or was it all in fun? There seemed to be a brief data burst, and then the phrase, "Varmint, I'm gonna blow you to smithereens." Yes, the voice of Yosemite Sam from Looney Tunes, and indeed that's how this service is now known, Yosemite Sam. I heard him myself shortly before. It turned out he disappeared, possibly forever. Fortunately, thanks to the spynumbers.com website, we have this recording. It seemed likely the transmitter's site was in the southwestern U.S., since the 3700 kHz frequency was heard during the local daytime in Tucson. And then the ARRL Intruder Watch reported that, according to the FCC monitoring station, the site was near Albuquerque, New Mexico. Harry Helms forwards a story from RadioInc.com in December that a new radio station just for women is coming to Utah in early 05. Bonneville, which operates KSL 1160, will be doing a new station, building it from the ground up, they say, known as AM 820. Well, there's already a station licensed for Taylorsville, Utah, KUTR, on that frequency. Don't know if they'll be changing call sign. AM 820 will feature info and conversation primarily for women. We're looking at all aspects of how the station can provide info for female listeners, conducting formal and informal research, says VP for Operations and Programming Rod Arquette. Our nearest public radio station, KOSU 91.7 in Stillwater, Oklahoma, has been announcing it'll soon be heard in four states, not only Oklahoma, but Arkansas, Missouri, and Kansas. This refers to their acquisition of a commercial station near Tulsa, KGND 107.5 in Ketchum, Oklahoma, which is going to be relaying KOSU. Ketchum is not far from the borders of Arkansas and Missouri, and Kansas not too far either, so it's in a four-state area. This project, I think, is to go on the air sometime during KOSU's 50th anniversary year, 2005. It had still not started when I was visiting Tulsa in late December. FM Media says the new call letters will be KOSN. I've also heard announcements on KOSU about their expanding in the other direction to bring better reception into the Oklahoma City area. Not sure what relay station or frequency they have in mind there. On the radio info discussion board for Oklahoma, Billy G. in Texas says WBBZ 1230 in Ponca City, Oklahoma, is still owned by a local newspaper and no other radio station. Still in the same building near the tower and sound pretty much the same way they did over 20 years ago. They might be the last small-town AM station in Oklahoma to still have live and local DJs with a full-service format, playing mostly oldies and some adult contemporary cuts, the way radio should still be. And they're also broadcasting on the web at www.wbbz.com. I haven't checked lately since my AM stereo radio is not normally fired up, but last time I did check, they were also broadcasting their music in AM stereo. Harry Helms forwards a story from eMediaWire.com that at its 102 interstate highway rest areas by October this year, Texas is offering free Wi-Fi internet access. The newest three stops are on US 287 near Headley and Quanah, which, contrary to the story, are southeast, not west of Amarillo. Another one in the Medina County Safety Rest Area, west, not east, of San Antonio on US 90. Actually, this comes from www.roadconnect.net. At no cost to the state, Coach Connect installing all the equipment necessary for a broadband internet signal. Travelers with wireless-enabled computers will have immediate and free access to Road Connect, a suite of products and services including local community info and 2 hours of free wireless Wi-Fi access to the World Wide Web. More and more states are providing wired internet access, at least at their visitor centers, notably New Mexico. The digital transition in broadcasting may have some tax benefits for broadcasters, thanks to some smart maneuvering. TV stations in particular, who are being forced to abandon analog for DTV. Their analog equipment normally depreciates to the point where they only have to pay 20% of the original rate in residual taxes. But with all this analog equipment soon to become worthless, a figure as low as 1/10 of that is being pushed for. Something equivalent could be in store for radio stations going IBOC, oops, I mean high definition, and even shortwave stations with DRM looming. On the NRC AM list, Rene Tetro in Pennsylvania says, the company I worked for in Tennessee still speeds up records on two of their stations, WXBQ-FM with a country format and WAEZ with contemporary hits. Whenever I installed new Denon 951 CD players, before putting them in the studios, I had to reset the speed. The speed up, though, was just 1.6%, a lot slower than the 5% we used to do on stations back in the 70s. It was just enough to give the music some punch or excitement. That's the program director's terminology, but not really noticeable unless you were looking for it. Also on the NRC AM list, Tom Ray, chief engineer of WOR 710 in New York, wrote in late December, we are progressing on building the new WOR transmitter facility in Rutherford, New Jersey. I would guess around March, we'll be starting the non-directional proof, which means we'll be adjusting matching overnight. I'll try to give some advance notice when WOR will be off the air, or at least off sporadically. Some of these will be last-minute decisions, but I'll try to give a week's notice. This would be a good chance to check 710, if Fidel isn't occupying it. Since New York City is rated overnight, it's very rare to find WOR off the air for any length of time. The new facility should work pretty well. It is literally being built in a swamp, and the bedrock is 165 feet deep. The transmitter building, guy anchors, and tower bases sit on steel pilings 165 feet deep. It makes a hell of a ground rod. And if anyone is in the New York City area, feel free to give me or our chief engineer, Kerry Richards, a shout if you'd like to tour the facility. We'd be happy to show anyone around anytime, says Tom Ray of WOR. Once again, I lament that, as far as I know, no U.S. shortwave station ever plays the Star-Spangled Banner. Here's a medium-wave station, however, which does. On the NRC AM list, Mark DiLorenzo on Cape Cod says, the last couple of mornings while getting ready for work, I've noticed that WBT 1110 in Charlotte, North Carolina, plays a full-length instrumental version of the Star-Spangled Banner at 6:08 a.m. Eastern Time. That might help a DXer west of the Mississippi identify WBT. Dan Say forwards a story from BBC News by Alex Kirby, forecasters face losing key tools. Meteorologists fear they're losing one of their essential forecasting tools, microwave frequencies, uniquely able to see through clouds from satellites. Commercial applications, for example, mobile phones and collision avoidance systems, are ruining them. The use of the bands in this way causes interference and contaminates the data from the satellites, making it useless. Not only weather forecasting is at risk, but also a better understanding of how climate change is developing. Progress in both forecasting and climate studies depends on observations from space of the Earth's surface and atmosphere. Dr. Steve Foreman of the Meteorological Office says many of these observations depend in turn on using microwave frequency bands, increasingly in demand for terrestrial use. We're in a David and Goliath situation, arguing to the ITU for the safety and humanitarian uses of frequencies against some applications with very strong financial backing. Examples include mobiles, wireless networking, other long-distance radio communications, and remote triggering devices. New military communications technologies are reported to pose another threat. Dr. Stephen English is manager of the Satellite Radiance Assimilation Group at the UK Met Office. He told the BBC, microwave observations are vital because they see through clouds. This is not possible in any other frequency band. We only need a few narrow frequency bands for Earth remote sensing, but most of these are unique, so there is no alternative. These bands are primarily used for temperature, water vapor, sea ice, clouds, ice and liquid, and rainfall and snowfall estimation. We use them as well for monitoring surface snowpack, soil moisture, and sea surface temperature. A meteorologist working group on frequency management says protecting key regions of the microwave spectrum for passive remote sensing is a dramatic challenge because of the huge pressure of the commercial and military telecoms. Two important bands, 6.8 and 10.7 gigahertz, have been lost already for use over land, but in the next few years, the threat is likely to spread to other bands. There is particular concern about protecting the 23.6 to 24 gigahertz band, which has the unique property of being sensitive to water vapor, but not to liquid water. Dr. English said there is no other frequency where this occurs, but car radars will now be allowed to broadcast in this band. Experts say this ban should not be jeopardized under any circumstances, and all emissions able to cause interference should be prohibited. Finding a shortwave oddity, it's not unusual to hear an echo on a shortwave signal, and usually they're just annoying and may cause you to tune elsewhere. For example, if there is a double satellite feed by mistake, there may be a 300 millisecond delay, and that's of no particular interest. But if it's a much shorter echo, more like a reverb, it could be a long-path signal being received simultaneously with a short-path signal. And the closer you are to the transmitter, therefore the farther you are from the transmitter via long-path. I've heard this before on WHRA 17650 in Maine, as received in Oklahoma, but now I've heard a station even further away, VOA Greenville, North Carolina, on 17580, December 31st at 1843 in French, with that noticeable long-path echo, meaning the other signal was coming around at a distance of some 38 megameters. Glenn Hauser concluding Continent of Media 0501, also known as World of Radio Extra 55.